Muy buenas tardes, good afternoon. This is Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM, live on the internet at www.cooperadio.org. This is a Co-op Radio special. We'll be with you for the next 2.5 hours on the subject of life in the universe, exploring the issue of life in the universe and its implications for our 21st century with expert guests in the planetary sciences and the emerging social science of exopolitics. Your hosts are Don Norden and Alfred Weber of the Bundy Brownbagger, and we feel privileged to be with you here today. First of all, let me say that this is this 2.5 hour Co-op Radio special on life in the universe is part of a celebration of 30 years of Co-op Radio. That's right, Co-op Radio, listener-sponsored alternative radio, will be 30 years old this year, this month, and we are celebrating our sustainability. And as you know, we Co-op Radio is an alternative voice. So this program will serve two functions. One is to bring you breakthrough information that you will not hear elsewhere in the mainstream media about life in the universe. And the second is to reach out to you, our listeners. We know that this program has stimulated a great deal of interest, not only here in Vancouver, but in various parts of the world. It is up on Peace and other websites throughout the world. And we're going to be asking you periodically on the half hour over the next 2.5 hours to call in. Bea Bernhausen and Nina Westaway are waiting for your call to renew your memberships in Co-op Radio if you're not a member, or to take out a new membership. And that's at 604. Take out your pencils, please. 604-684-8494. Nope, Co-op Radio is a media outlet for the economically, socially, and politically disadvantaged, and we are listener sponsored, so we're relying on you. We know that there are a lot of listener phone calls that are lined up for this program, and we are diverting them to your calls to sustain us. Now, we do have a prize, and that is a copy of the newly available book, Exopolitics: Politics, Government, and Law in the Universe. This is an emerging social science. It's a $25 value. And at the end of the program, we'll be drawing from the names of those who do renew their memberships or take out new memberships, and you will receive a brand new copy of Exopolitics, Politics, Government, and Law in the Universe. So, without further ado, I'm going to turn this over to Don Norden for our first guest in our special Co-op Radio program, Life in the Universe.
Thanks, Alfred. And that book, by the way, that is being offered as a door prize is authored by Alfred Weber, the co-host of today's program, who you've just heard. The lineup today, first of all, we'll be speaking to Dr. John B. Murray in the Department of Earth Sciences from the Open University in the UK. Second of all will be Dr. R. Leo Sprinkle of the University of Wyoming. And then Peter Davenport from the UFO Reporting Center in Seattle. Dr. Courtney Brown on scientific remote viewing and contact with off-planet cultures. And finally, I'll be interviewing Alfred Weber on his new book, Exopolitics: Politics, Government, and Law in the Universe. And so with that, we'll go to Dr. John B. Murray, and I'll put on my headphones here so I can hear. Hello, John?
Hello.
Hi, how are you today?
I'm fine, thanks. It's evening here, so it's just getting dark.
Yeah, you're looking at 8 p.m. over there.
Yeah, that's right.
By the way, Ron, is it possible to turn the level up on these headphones a little bit more? Oh, that's fine. Yeah, thank you. Okay, John, let's get into it. John Murray is a researcher in the twin fields of planetary science and volcanology. He has an MA and a PhD in earth sciences and also a degree in lunar geology. He is presently a research lecturer at the Open University in the UK. In the summer of 2000, he was appointed a co-investigator on the high-resolution stereo camera experiment on board the ESA Mars Express mission. John Murray has participated in various ways in the study of our moon, the planets, Mercury and Mars, and the large moons of Jupiter, as well as the moon of Mars, Phobos. In 1999, he presented evidence for a distant trans-Plutonian planet based on anomalies in the distribution and orbital periods of long-period comets. In 2000, he was appointed a co-investigator on HRSC when it was relaunched on the highly successful Mars Express mission, which reached Mars orbit at the end of 2003 and has since attracted great public interest and support and considerable media coverage. And these are many introductions. There's much more to read about John, but if you want to learn more, you can do maybe a Google search on John B. Murray. Okay, John, the first point I want to touch on is life on non-terrestrial planets in our solar system. Do you think that life existed in the past on any of the planets in our solar system aside from Earth?
I think it's possible, yes. To actually go ahead and say that I believe it existed, there's not enough evidence to do that, but over the past year, since Mars Express has been in orbit, I think there's more and more evidence that the surface of Mars, there are many places on the surface of Mars where life could have existed in the past. Of course, we don't have any direct evidence for it, but what we found during this mission is that the habitats are there, and they're of two or three different types. So it does look to me as if life could have developed there in the past.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, from what I've learned over the internet, there are signs of a possible frozen ocean covered by dust. There are signs of channels which may have been caused by erosion of water, running water. And also on another website, I forget which one it was now, but there were also what appeared to be fossilized remnants of ancient sea life, mm-hmm. such as trilobites and shellfish and so forth. Have you seen those?
No, I haven't seen those sites. I'd be interested to see those. No, I mean, the evidence that I found was about a year ago, quite early on in the Mars Express mission. I was looking at one of the images, and these are very, very big images. They're about 65 kilometers wide, but they're thousands of kilometers long, yet they have resolutions right down to 10 meters. So it's a bit like looking at a stair carpet or a long sort of carpet about 100 foot long and say a couple of feet wide. So it takes a long time to go through an entire image. Of course, you do it on a computer screen, so it takes about 2 hours to go all the way through an image to look at it. But down the south end of one of these images, I found these curious platy structures, and what attracted my attention was that one of them was quite obviously rotated. It had broken up and rotated, so that did not look like geological cracking or erosion or any kind of tectonic faulting. It looked as if something, as if these plates were floating on something. And as I looked at it, it just struck me that the whole area looked as if it was covered in pack ice, such as you'd see in the Arctic Ocean or the Antarctic Ocean, or in the Gulf of St. Lawrence, places like that. I mean, the sort of thing you can see out of an aeroplane window, that we've all seen out of aeroplane windows. It looked very much like that. Now, my initial reaction was, what on earth is this doing on Mars, and what is it doing at the equator of Mars? Because this is about 5 degrees north of the equator. So I was sort of skeptical at first, but then the more we looked into it, the more I became convinced that this was, in fact, pack ice, or the traces of pack ice on the surface of an ocean. And it's a very extensive area, and it's at least 800 by 900 kilometers, so I think that's about the size of Lake Michigan. It's the size of the North Sea, but that might not be familiar to Canadians, but I think it's something like the size of Lake Michigan. So it's a huge area of, or a huge lake or sea, or whatever you like to call it, and it's been covered by volcanic dust and ash, and that's what's caused it to still be there today, because ice is not actually stable on the surface of Mars. It does sublime. That means it goes from the solid straight into the gaseous state without passing through the liquid state. That's what happens to water ice on the surface of Mars, because the atmospheric pressure is so low.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your opinion, if there was water or is pack ice in certain areas, would you think it might be possible that there might be some water at some depth under this pack ice still existing?
No, I don't think liquid water. I think all the models show that it's solidified all the way through. And we can get an estimate of the depth of the sea by looking at craters which just touch the surface, impact craters. And we're getting depths between about 30 meters and 60 meters. So it's not that deep. Again, it's about the depth of the North Sea, but it's not like deep sea trenches that you get on Earth.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, if you look at where the water has come from, you can see a very deeply eroded channel that runs about 200 or 300 kilometers into this particular area. And if you look at where that water channel comes from, it's from a series of very deep and long cracks in the surface of Mars, fissures called the Cerberus fossae. And these are very recently opened. I mean, when I say recent, I mean a few million years old, but that's very recent in geological terms. So it's quite clear that the water has erupted from these fissures. Now, that's interesting in itself, in that it does suggest that there are huge reserves of liquid water beneath the surface of Mars, and seeing as they still erupt to virtually today, then it suggests that we've actually got liquid water beneath the surface now. We've known for a long time that these eruptions of water have occurred much earlier in Mars' geological history, and there are several places on the surface where you can see large canyons and you can see huge water channels that are issuing from them. Some of these channels are more than 100 kilometers wide, so we've had catastrophic eruptions of water from beneath the surface of Mars, and they flowed downslope. Now, seeing as we've had this liquid water beneath the surface for so long, we're talking about thousands of millions of years, then that's plenty of time for life to develop. So if life can develop under those circumstances, then it's likely that it will have developed.
Do you think in the early history of Mars that there may have been an atmosphere sufficiently thick to support life, you know, the higher forms of life on land, and also to produce that would might have produced rain clouds and precipitation and that type of thing?
I think that's quite possible, yes, very early in the history of Mars. I mean, I think most people believe that there was a warm, wet phase when the atmospheric pressure was much greater. Now, whether there would have been sufficient time for life to evolve to higher forms, I'm not so sure. I mean, if we look at life on Earth, the first signs of life are thousands of millions of years ago. I'm talking about 2,000 or 3,000 million years, and they're very primitive microorganisms, and nothing really happens until about half a billion years ago, when those early forms of life start to become more complex and to evolve, and we get things which are more familiar to us, not just single-celled animals, but complex animals, you know, eventually evolving into the higher forms of life that we know today. So if you think about that, it looks as if single-celled, very primitive microorganisms were existing on the surface of the Earth for about 1 or 2 thousand million years before they actually developed into higher forms of life. So they would have had to, I think, have been something rather different going on Mars for life to have evolved much more rapidly than that, and there's no sign really that that ever happened.
Now, it is speculated that there may have been Martian life forms that have been blasted away from the surface of Mars and entered into the Earth's atmosphere and possibly could have, you know, revived and come to life there. Also, I read on a website that a new species of bacteria that was frozen for 32,000 years beneath the Alaska tundra has been revived, and also bacteria from 100 million-year-old salt crystals have been revived. And so this brings up a possibility of life forms that are floating around in space from wherever, entering the atmospheres of planets that are capable of supporting life and then being revived in that type of environment. Do you think this is possible?
I think it's always possible. I think it's unlikely because once something gets out into space, and particularly if it gets near the sun, then it's going to be subject to bombardment by ultraviolet light and other particles that would tend to break the compounds apart and so destroy what was ever there. But it's always a possibility, for example, you know, within a meteorite or something like that, that life could survive the journey from one planet to another. I mean, there was a lot of excitement about 10 years ago, I think it was about 1995, when a Martian meteorite was found. That's a piece of Mars that had been ejected by impact from Mars, and it had made the journey all the way to Earth. I think there are about 10 or 12 of these meteorites that have been found. Now, one of these did contain something that looked to the uninitiated like it could have been some kind of a microfossil. It looks like a little tiny segmented worm. But on the other hand, there are minerals and compounds and structures that occur that look remarkably like that, which actually have nothing to do with life. But it did certainly excite a lot of interest at the time, and people began to speculate about whether this could actually happen.
Mm-hmm. Okay, there's a lot more we could say about Mars, but let's move on to other bodies in the solar system. Do you think there are other bodies, such as some of the large moons of the gas giants, that could be now be supporting life?
It's a possibility. I think it's less likely than Mars. I think Mars is the place where we're most likely to find life, and you know, there has been other circumstantial evidence that we haven't talked about which suggests that might even be existing now. But I mean, if we look at other places in the solar system, I think most people agree that Europa, that's the second of the large satellites of Jupiter, might be the best place to find it, if it's not found on Mars. Now, Europa is the surface is composed of ice, water ice, mainly water ice. It's probably at least 100 kilometers thick. And the interesting thing about Europa is that it's so close to Jupiter that when it, because of small irregularities in its orbit, when it gets nearer and closer to Jupiter, the gravitational pull of Jupiter on it causes it to squash and sort of stretch itself, and that squashing and stretching, that sort of kneading, if you like, of Europa, causes the interior to heat up. So you've got a sort of gravitationally heated interior. Now, if the interior is heated like that, then it's highly likely that the bottom of this water ice, deep down within Europa, you get a layer where you actually have liquid water. And liquid water, I think, is, most people agree, is one of the main constituents that you need for life. If we're looking at what we need for life to develop, you need carbon compounds, probably a few other things too, but essentially carbon compounds and liquid water and some source of energy. Now, on Earth, of course, the source of energy is the sun, but if we imagine deep beneath the surface of Europa, it might be possible for life to develop, and instead of the sun, you actually have this gravitational tidal heating of the interior of Europa as the source of energy, which might, under some circumstances, allow life to develop. Certainly, we used not to think that life would be possible deep inside, deep beneath the oceans, because there's no sunlight gets through. But as we now know, there are whole ecosystems that live around hydrothermal vents deep in the floor of deep oceans on the Earth, and you get not just microorganisms but other creatures living and existing there without ever seeing the sun. So I think the idea is that a similar kind of life might have developed entirely on its own under that situation on Europa.
Yeah, that's interesting. And this life, the life forms that we observe down there are much identical to the life forms that we observe in the shallow waters of the ocean.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the microorganisms that evolve in deep oceans are common ancestors to several forms of life on Earth.
Mm-hmm. So there would be a sort of the same evolutionary trend of those microorganisms as there would on the surface.
It could well be.
You say that the ice was 60 miles or 100 kilometers thick, could be on Europa. That must indicate a very deep body of water there, if there still would be water below that.
Yes, I mean, there's most of the moons of Jupiter have a high proportion of water ice in them, but Europa is near enough to Jupiter to undergo this tidal gravitational heating, so that's why that's probably the most likely place for us to get life, for us to get liquid water and to get life developing.
Well, lastly, could we touch on the gas giants themselves? You know, there are various layers in the atmosphere of the gas giants. Do you think it is possible that it could be some form of life that has evolved within certain layers that might be more hospitable to the development of life than others?
It's an interesting thought. I haven't heard of anyone who seriously proposed that for any of the gas giants. The only other place that people have speculated about life forming is on Titan. That's the one of the satellites of Saturn that we've just landed on, of course, or landed on earlier this year. And that's really because the atmosphere of Titan is so rich in hydrocarbons, so that's carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, and oxygen compounds, which are essentials of life. But there are problems, certainly, with finding life on Titan. It's very, very cold. I mean, you're talking about minus 180 degrees centigrade. Though, like on Europa, it's possible that deep within it there might be a layer of liquid water. but I think most people consider that rather unlikely, but certainly more unlikely than on Europa, and Europa itself is more unlikely than on Mars.
Well, you know, we're already coming up to the half hour here. As a final point, then, I would ask you, what do you hope for in the future exploration of our solar system? What are your hopes that we might do?
Well, I hope that we'll send an exobiology mission to Mars in 2009. Well, that is a possibility that the European Space Agency might do that. I think the generally agreed date most people are talking about is 2011. But if we can land a probe on the frozen sea, because I think that's the most likely place to find life. The point there is because the sea is so young, we've got a date for that of about 5 million years. And from what you were saying about bacteria being revived after 32,000 years, and it's possible that if we can drill down into the ice, that not only we won't be finding fossils, we're actually be finding the frozen microorganisms themselves. So there might be a possibility that these could be revived. Another thing we haven't talked about is a piece of research that was published a couple of days after I first presented this, gave my presentation on the frozen sea in Holland in February, and that is that in the ice of Alaska, they've actually found microorganisms surviving at 40 degrees below zero, not just surviving but actually functioning, actually apparently reproducing and giving off gases. The main gas they give off is carbon dioxide and methane, and carbon dioxide is the principal constituent of the atmosphere of Mars, and methane is one of the gases that Mars Express detected. And the frozen sea of Mars is the place on Mars where we find the highest concentration of methane. So the evidence is building up. It's certainly changed the entire way I've thought about Mars. The way I think about it now is very, very different from what I thought a year ago.
And finally, one might speculate that with these discoveries that vastly increase the probabilities of life, even intelligent life, existing around other stars outside our solar system.
Yes. I mean, if we do find that life has actually managed to develop somewhere else in our own solar system, then I think that's a pretty strong indication that it's a common phenomenon throughout the universe. If we don't find it, it doesn't necessarily mean it's not a common phenomenon, but it might be. The big question is then, why don't we find it? You know, why is the Earth so special? And both of those are extremely interesting questions.
Well, I thank you very much for appearing on our program today.
Not at all. It's been a great pleasure.
Thank you very much.
This is Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO, 102.7 FM, www.cooperadio.org on the internet. You're listening to a special program celebrating 30 years of Co-op Radio, 30 years of sustainability. And we exist because we're a listener-sponsored radio station, a community radio station, a cooperative radio station. We are not beholden to commercial advertisers. We are not beholden to their censorship. We are not beholden to the self-censorship that appears in the mainstream media. Imagine a life without co-op radio. And we were the only radio station in our area that we're able to bring you the inside story of various directed energy weapons, the inside story of microwave warfare against the Population, the inside story of marginalized community and people fighting for social change. So we ask you to take a moment at this time and pick up your telephones as you're listening to the radio. You can renew your membership in Co-op Radio if it's lapsed, and there are various membership plans for people with fixed incomes and students and others. And call this number. It's 604-684-8494. That's 604-684-8494. We cannot lay the responsibility of keeping Co-op Radio sustainable further on other people. We are a collective. Our listeners are actually the owners of the station. Our members are our listeners, and Co-op Radio is a collective enterprise that depends on you, on your generosity and your sense of responsibility. So you're listening to a very special program on life in the universe, and we are going to be exploring some areas that are quite new in terms of new paradigms of science and new paradigms of understanding how life might manifest in the universe. And again, we have a prize for the listeners who do call in and renew their memberships, and that's a copy of the newly released Canadian book, Exopolitics, Politics, Government, and Law in the Universe. It's a $25 value. At the end of the program, we'll be drawing the names of those who did call in and renew or take out memberships, and you'll be able to come down to the station and pick up your copy if your names happen to be chosen. So we are going to be arriving at another guest, and I'm going to turn it over to my co-host while we're contacting that guest, to my co-host Don Norden, to continue reaching out to you, our listeners, to call in to 604-684-8494.
Oh, okay. Thanks, Alfred. Yeah, today is today's program is not only a special, but it's special in the sense that it is the first radio program of its kind to focus in a broad manner on intelligent life in our universe, and so we hope you'll enjoy it. We're enjoying it so far. And I think you're going to find the program quite exciting from this point onwards, even more exciting than it's been so far. And you've already learned from our first guest that, life within our solar system might not be that uncommon. And so right starting now, we're going to be exploring other areas of life within our universe. And again, we invite you to call in if you want to renew your membership or get a new membership, and we hope you'll do that to support Co-op Radio and support the work that we're doing. And the number to phone is 604-684-7561, and if you become a member or renew your membership, you will be on our list for the door prize of Alfred's book, Exopolitics. And the number to call is 604-684-8494. That's 604-684-8494. And back to Alfred.
Yes. Now, we're very privileged to have on the line from Wyoming, Professor R. Leo Sprinkle, Professor Emeritus at the University of Wyoming. Dr. Sprinkle has authored a half dozen book chapters, several encyclopedia entries, the author of the book Soul Samples, and approximately 50 articles on topics related to life in the universe. He's a member of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, the American Association for Counseling and Development, and the Association for Past Life Research and Therapies. And as a professor at the University of Wyoming and a therapist, Dr. Sprinkle, who is a pioneer in this field, has conducted over 500 hypnotic regression sessions with individuals looking to explore their possible contact experience with other life forms in the universe. Dr. Sprinkle?
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Welcome to our program. We're very happy to have you here.
Pleasure to be here.
Okay. Leo, we are the focus of this program is on the subject of life in the universe, and we're looking at it through various ways of approaching it and through various scientific paradigms. And of course, the dominant sort of worldview of the 20th century was that intelligent life stopped at Earth's geostationary orbit. That is, we are in this vast universe, and planet Earth, Sol 3, all intelligent life stops here. And you have been a pioneer in this area, and some of the cases that you've studied are among the most well-documented cases of our times. And I wondered if you could begin to share with our listeners, some of whom may be familiar with this material and some of whom may not be, what the scientific evidentiary base is, including hypnotic regression sessions, for supporting a worldview that the universe may be populated by other intelligent civilizations as well.
Yes, be glad to. First, let me mention something that occurred at one of our UFO conferences at the University of Wyoming back in the 80s and 90s, of which you were also a prominent guest. Dr. James Deardorff, professor of atmospheric sciences at Oregon State University, pointed out that there were three different phrases or three different eras of attitudes about extraterrestrial life. The predominant one for many years was, "We are alone." Then there were astronomers who came along younger and different in their views, including Carl Sagan and others, who said, "Well, we're not alone. There are a lot of other civilizations, but they're too far away to get here." And then, after that phase, there was a current one, and that is ETs are here. That is not always popular among statements by prominent theorists, but that seems to be the view that is being taken now. And then a book by Axel, Probability One, refers to the notion that both observations and mathematics, probability theory, would argue that the universe is populated throughout. So I like that as a background. And then as more focused on what you were asking, I have worked with many people, not only individually, but of course in groups, workshops. I've been at various conferences in Korea, Japan, Finland, England, Canada, Mexico, Brazil, many places where different people from different walks of life, different educational and social and religious backgrounds, all these people report encounters with beings. They may have different attitudes about them. Some people are frightened, some people are not frightened, many are puzzled, but there seems to be a worldwide awareness that so-called flying saucers or spacecraft not only are being piloted by beings, but sometimes those beings step out and interact with humans. So there's a great deal of literature, various stripes and various levels of evidence, but the evidence is overwhelming, in my opinion, that ETs are not only out there, but ETs are also seen and interacted with on the planet. The individuals I've worked with also differ in terms of their background, but there seems to be a couple of characteristics that are predominant, and that seems to be true of the work of other people. Dr. Eddie Bullard, a professor of folklore at University of Indiana, has described some of these characteristics in terms of the sessions, but I'll just mention a couple that I found. Most of these people, for one reason or another, we don't know whether it's before or after their experience, seem to be highly interested in psychic phenomena, paranormal events, and also these people seem to be highly interested in spirituality, not the traditional religious church-attending dogma, but the sense that all of creation is one. There is a connection between the levels of consciousness of plants, animals, people. And those two characteristics are very interesting to me because they would suggest that either they're being sought out for these encounters, or as a result of these encounters, they are moving toward that philosophy.
Now, perhaps could you share with our listeners perhaps one of the two documented cases emerging from your research, either from regression or some other evidentiary base, that suggests that meaningful interaction between humans and intelligent living beings that are off-planet, representatives of off-planet cultures, are occurring.
Yes, one case that got some attention in the literature as well as in public media, a Japanese company came over to videotape sessions with Carl Higdon, Everett Carl Higdon Jr., now living with his wife Marjorie in Texas, at that time was in Rawlins, Wyoming, and I got a call from a couple of friends who asked me if I would come to Rawlins, which is about 100 miles from Laramie, and see if hypnotic techniques would help Carl understand more about his experience. He had gone out one afternoon to hunt elk with his rifle. I've seen him fire his rifle. It's a powerful weapon. It'll place a bullet through a 12-inch trunk tree. He'd gone out in the afternoon, but people hadn't heard from him until later at night, and he radioed back kind of a garbled message. Some people got in four-wheel drive pickups to go and look for him. His wife, Margie, and a friend were at the edge of the woods where he had been, and they saw an object that they thought of as a glowing object move up and away from that area. The people who went in there found Carl in a dazed condition. He was taken to a hospital. Physician and nurse I interviewed later to talk with him about what they had found. It didn't seem to be as a result of drug experience or anything like that. All he was saying is, they got my elk, they got my elk. later on, during hypnosis session, what seemed to have occurred was that Carl had parked his pickup truck in a wood south of Rawlins, and in a clearing he saw some elk. He aimed his rifle, fired at the bull elk. He could see there was a muffled sound instead of the sharp crack of the rifle. He could see the bullet move out away from the barrel of the rifle, and then it fell to the ground. Puzzled, he went over to pick it up, turned around, and saw this character, 6 foot or taller, human-like in terms of appearance, except that the head had hair that was like straws coming out, a little different kind of features than most humans, either verbal or telepathic communication occurred, and eventually the being, who he later called Ozo One, asked him if Carl would like to go with him. And Carl said, "I don't know why I said yes, but I said yes." And so he felt himself taken into a large craft, rectangular in shape, and inside appeared to be larger than outside, which was strange to him. He sat at what he thought were controls, seeing a logo that looked like a cloud, which was similar to the figure's apron or lap cloth. The being was in a kind of what we'd call a spacesuit, tightly fitting, and motioned towards the machinery, and apparently the craft took off, later landed in a place that seemed to be off Earth, with a human standing there, and into a large building. We have drawings of those statements that Carl made during the hypnosis sessions, and would indicate that he went up on what seemed to be like an elevator into a large room up on a platform with what seemed to be an examination, and then he was told, "We'll take you back. You're not what we want." We asked him what did that mean, and he didn't know. Although he did say that he had a vasectomy. His wife said, "You mean vasectomy?" He said, "Well, whatever." Carl is an honest person, and his work with oil rig crews indicates that he's a person of responsibility. He doesn't consider himself highly educated, but he does think of himself as very observant. And I remember one night spending there when there was a blizzard, and he showed me how pool can be played. I believe that he has good eye-hand coordination, and he sees very well. He wasn't sure about the meaning of the experiences and the hypnosis session because he didn't have conscious memory of the events. But he was willing to undergo a variety of examinations, the personality surveys, the hypnosis session. He was willing to undergo a polygraph examination, lie detector test. The first result of the lie detector test was kind of ambiguous. The police chief, a friend of mine, said, "Well, Leo, I don't know. It's hard to tell on some of these questions." So I told Carl, he said, "I'm being as honest as I can be, so go ahead with the telling of the story, even if it doesn't turn out very well as far as the lie detector test." Well, I puzzled about it, and I went back to the polygraph examiner, and I said, "How about changing the questions? Instead of saying, 'Did you go on board a craft? Did you talk with an ET?' How about saying, 'Do you believe that you were on board a craft, and do you believe that you talked with an ET?'" Well, of course he does. But he is so literal-minded that if someone asks him, "Did it happen?" he says, "I don't know. It only came out during the hypnosis session." So if one does not like hypnotic procedures as a way of getting at memories, then one can dismiss that information. However, if one thinks of it as a hoax, then Leo's the hoaxer because Carl's the honest guy. And also the report of the other people who went in and found Carl, and the report of the physician and the nurse, as well as wife and friend, all support what supposedly happened that evening. Plus, other times, things have happened that are strange. Carl will get a tingling in his shoulder, and he'll have someone go outside and look up, and they see a craft or a light in the sky. So there seems to be, at least at that time of the investigation, there seemed to be an ongoing communication with the ETs. And the information is very interesting. For example, when Carl was taken back down to Earth, according to his memory under hypnosis session, the man looked at the rifle and said, "That's a primitive weapon," which a lot of people would agree with now, and also his feeling that he was beamed down, but then when he came close to Earth, he fell and hurt his shoulder, and that shoulder is the same shoulder that whenever he gets this feeling, this tingling, well, that's when the communication seemed to take place. So there's an ongoing communication that is significant. The bullet was very interesting. The lead core was missing. Carl loaned it to me, and I gave it to a metallurgist to look at, as well as a specialist in weapons, and they all report unusual observations of it. The trouble was that one time when I was going to send it to another laboratory, well, the casing is missing, and that's very strange. I don't know how to account for it. One person who seems to be psychic believes that it was dematerialized. And so this is similar to claims of many people that objects come and go, as well as the ETs themselves. So that's one case that has gotten some interest because Carl seems to have changed his views about life and the universe as a result of his experience. Another person who is interesting to talk about is a woman, Ida Cannenberg, great-grandmother in her late 80s, now she's in her 90s now. She's written four books, has a couple others on the way, a very intelligent, very good writer, and she had an experience in California with her husband and a young man. They were driving from Oregon down to Texas for the young man's army duty. They stopped at one point thinking they were looking at the full moon. The men got out. Ida went into kind of a trance state, and later, many years later, because that was in the 40s, in the 70s, she underwent hypnosis to remember what had happened then. Supposedly what happened was that ETs came to the car, asked her to get out to help someone, and they went to a spacecraft and talked with the ETs, although that information was not recalled until the 70s in the hypnosis session. As a result, some interesting things happened. She checked back and found that on that date, and they knew when they had traveled in California, that it was not a full moon, it was a quarter moon or something. And so what they were looking at was a glowing object, which later she said was the spacecraft. She continued to have telepathic information. It frightened her at first. She tried to talk about it to people. People thought she was crazy. Her family even asked her to go see a psychiatrist in a mental hospital. He proclaimed that she was not crazy, and was released, and so she says now she's certified sane. And she's a delightful person with wit and charm, but she fought this ET connection for many years. Finally, she, after asking a lot of questions and getting a lot of telepathic impressions about life, she wrote a book on the psychic factor of UFOs. Then she wrote a book about alien, book of knowledge, and then a book about planet Earth and the message. And more recently, she's written a book called Reconciliation, which is her interpretation of the reconciliation not only between humans and their various religious views, but also between humans and the gods or the extraterrestrial forces and their philosophy. Her basic view is that humanity is going through a social initiation, just as individuals and their ET encounters are individual initiations. By initiation, she means moving from one level of awareness to another level, and it's rather detailed and complex, but the basic notion is that we are moving from being planetary persons to being cosmic citizens. So those are two cases that show you an average man, quote-quote, working man, and a scholar, and yet they both have talked at our UFO conference, and just like many people, they feel the connection they have not only as humans but also as star seed or star children or star people.
You know, Professor Sprinkle, our time is just flying by, and we're in the last couple of minutes of this segment, believe it or not, which is now. So just in a couple of minutes, it seems as though there's a, well, one can say that there's a large database of replicable, meaning all of the criteria of the scientific method of cases that tend to confirm and suggest this sort of interaction. And Professor
yes.
Dierdorf, who you just mentioned, suggests that these encounters brings up the leaky embargo hypothesis, and that is that Earth has been under an information embargo from the rest of the populated universe, and that these UFO encounters of the first kind, second kind, third kind with personal interaction are deliberate leaks in the information embargo. And I wondered in just a minute or so if you could sum up where you think all of this is going.
I think that there are at least four levels: the physical, the biological, the psychosocial, and the spiritual. At the physical level, the craft. At the biological level, the ETs. Their message at the psychological level. And then the mission, it's what some people think of as a spiritual mission. That is seeing if Earth and humanity are ready to join the cosmic cultures or the Galactic Federation. And so his view about the embargo, I think, is very pertinent, that information is being withheld, but gradually allowed through the common person, and then later information and physical evidence allowed for the scientific and political leadership to examine, so that instead of frightening us, we are gradually becoming adapted to the idea that we're not alone, and that the ETs, even though they may appear as frightening to some people, Jeremy Vaney says the ETs are ally disguised as bully. And I like that notion, that we are gradually being adapted to the idea that they're here, that we need to become a one humanity or one planet before we are invited into the galactic culture. If that's the way it is, then there are two things that are resulting. One is we'll continue to see and hear and learn about these encounters, and the other thing is that our own level of consciousness, our own level of growth, is part of that process.
We want to thank you very, very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Alfred.
And we look forward to perhaps your coming on again in the future.
All right. Well, best wishes to you, and thank you very much.
Certainly.
Good day.
Good day. Yes, this is Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO, 102.7 FM, www.coopradio.org. We are about 1 hour into a 2.5-hour Co-op Radio special, Life in the Universe, celebrating sustainability, 30 years of Co-op Radio. Life in the Universe, does intelligent life end at the geostationary orbit? Instead of being an anomaly, other life-bearing planets in more ancient solar systems could be a regular feature of our universe. And new social science models, such as the exopolitics model, are helping us make sense of how intelligent life in a vast multidimensional universe might organize itself. But meanwhile, imagine a life without Co-op Radio. In this day and age, with the both the gentrification of media, the self-censorship, the corporate and commercial agenda, Co-op Radio as a listener-sponsored community cooperative radio station is unique. We exist because you exist. We are all part of a larger community. We depend on you, the listeners. And so please take a moment now and reflect as you begin to hear the information being brought to you, which you most certainly will not hear in mainstream media in a responsible context. And pick up the phone and call. Nina Westaway and Bea Bernhausen are waiting for your phone calls. You can either renew your membership. It may have lapsed, and you can just pick up the phone and renew it, or you may take out a membership and thereby keep us on the air for another 30 years and another 30 years thereafter. But we need your help now. We need to keep our lights going, our co-op radio studios going. We're here in a very beautiful, brand-new studio. Gee, this looks like a real radio station here. Ron Barber, our very excellent operator. Don Norton and myself, Alfred Weber, here. And we ask you to reach out to us and take on your responsibilities. And, hey, gift us. Contribute, become part of our living community. Call 604-684-8494. Talk to Bea. Talk to Nina. They're waiting for your phone calls. They will take you through the drill. There are different levels depending on what your income level is, fixed income, student, regular membership, etc., etc., etc. And we have a beautiful door prize. So I'm now going to turn the microphone over to my co-host, Don Norton, who will take us to the next segment of this exciting breakthrough. Believe me, this is a breakthrough. It's a subtle breakthrough, but it is a breakthrough program of life in the universe. Don?
Yeah, and before I go to Peter, I just wanted to say that this type of program, along with a lot of the programming that we do on co-op radio, is... It's not only if you donate, it's not only a gift to us, but it's a gift to yourselves. And we'll talk a little bit about that later. Why a contact with intelligent life in our universe is so important to people on the Earth at this present juncture in time. And that will be with Alfred Weber. But right now, I'm going to go to Peter Davenport. Peter Davenport is with the National UFO Reporting Center in Seattle. It is found on the web and is said to be the most comprehensive and up-to-date UFO information source provided by America's foremost UFO reporting agency in continuous operation since 1974. It can be found by doing a Google search using words, the National UFO Reporting Center, hyphen Peter Davenport. Peter Davenport has been the director of the National UFO Reporting Center since July 1994. He has also served as the director of investigation for the Washington chapter of the Mutual UFO Network. He has a bachelor's degree in both Russian and biology, as well as a translator's certificate in Russian translation. He has an MS degree in the genetics and biochemistry of fish and an MBA degree in finance and international business. In 1986, Peter was a candidate for the Washington State Legislature, and in 1992, he was a candidate for the U.S. House of Representatives. Peter has had an active interest in the UFO phenomena from his early boyhood. He experienced his first UFO sighting over the St. Louis Municipal Airport in the summer of 1954, and he has investigated his first UFO case during the summer of 1965 in Exeter, New Hampshire. Welcome to the program today, Peter.
Thank you very much, Don and Alfred. Nice to be here, and thank you for the invitation.
Well, it's a pleasure having you on.
Thank you.
Before we get into talk around your personal the sightings that have been reported to you personally, I just wanted you to talk for a few minutes about Stephen Greer and Project Disclosure and the many testimonials that have been given to Stephen, which again provide more evidence that there are UFOs and there is extraterrestrial life in the universe. What would you say in a brief summary of Stephen Greer's documentation?
Well, to be honest with you, Don, I'm not that familiar with the work he's done. I have to say, as a scientist, I prefer to deal only with the data that I have personal experience with and therefore am most familiar with and am aware of to the greatest degree. I have not, for whatever reason, I've not had close relationships with CSETI over the years.
Mm-hmm.
There are a host of reasons. I guess perhaps one is they're on the opposite coast from me. And again, I've not been invited to be part of their disclosure project. They did not contact me, for example, when they were looking for former military personnel who have had UFO sightings. So we haven't had that much contact, really. I'm aware of the disclosure project, of course. In fact, I think there have been two. One, the first one was in the spring of 1997 when Stephen and the CSETI staff had some operation in the Washington, D.C. area and invited members of Congress. But I'm rambling here. I apologize. I'm just not that familiar with it.
Okay, that's good enough. Okay, let's get into your experiences. How old were you when you had your first UFO sighting, and what did you think that UFO was at the time?
Oh, I'm delighted by the question. Thank you for asking it. And it poses a dilemma for me, because after 11 years in the UFO field of active day-to-day UFO work, I point out to people that it does no good really to talk about their UFO sightings. The only kind of report that really does any good is a formal written statement of fact. And yet when I'm asked the question to talk about my UFO sighting, I love to do it. So I'm committing the very crime in quotes, of course, that I try to have other people avoid. But I was 6 years of age in July of 1954, and thanks to Illinois MUFON, Dave Marler, the director, state director there, I now know the exact date of that event, I believe. It was the 12th of July, 1954. I was sitting in our family car, which was a 1953 Studebaker, and sitting at a drive-in theater on the edge of the St. Louis airport, and suddenly we became aware. My mother, my brother, and I were sitting in the car. My father was across on the other side of the airport in the control tower, and we became aware of a disturbance at the drive-in outdoor theater. And we looked around for a few seconds, couldn't see anything, and then realized that people were walking in front of our car, so we could not see the screen. And I looked out the right side of the automobile, that is to the east, that would be facing, and I saw the most incredible object that I have ever, in all my years, laid eyes on. It was as bright as the sun, or I think even brighter. It was the color of a red traffic signal. It was the shape generally of an almond, and it was hovering almost entirely motionless in the sky. It was drifting just very slowly, and suddenly it illuminated the entire theater and perhaps even the airport with a red light. Suddenly it accelerated, and it went from my right to gone over the horizon directly in front of our car in about 2 seconds, I estimate. It was a really, in my opinion, truly dramatic UFO sighting. That was my, so far as I'm aware, the first time I ever saw a UFO, and I think it set the hook in my jaw for UFO research.
Could you, do you have any idea, any estimation of how large it was and how far away it was at the time, and were there other people around you in the drive-in theater who you thought might have seen it?
Oh, everybody was looking at it. In fact, I think I'm correct in saying, Don, that nobody was paying attention to the movie. They were all out of their cars, standing 80 degrees to the right of the screen, staring at this thing, which was illuminating all of them in red light. In fact, even though this event occurred 51 years ago almost, it stands out in my memory as clearly as it would had it happened just last night, I feel. I remember, for example, one fellow who walked in front of our car who was sort of obscuring our view of the screen. He had a white T-shirt on, and he had a rather prominent paunch, and he had his cigarettes rolled up in the sleeve on the right side of his T-shirt, the way men were wont to do back in the 50s. And everybody in that theater was transfixed and looking at this object up in the sky. With regard to its distance from us, that is impossible to know, because although it was a clear sky, and I remember that very distinctly, there were no clouds in the sky, it is very difficult, even borderline impossible, to determine either the size or the range or distance to an unknown target unless you have one of those data sets. That is, if you don't know how far away it is, you don't know how large it is, and if you don't know how large it is, you don't know how far away it is. One of those dilemmas. But its apparent size, from our vantage point, the length of the object was a little bit larger than the diameter of a full moon. So we're talking about a very large object, relatively speaking, in the nighttime sky.
Mm-hmm. And did you have any personal feeling when you saw the object? And also, another question, was this object reported in the local media?
Yes, it was reported in the local media. The media back in the 50s did a much, much better job, in my opinion, of reporting UFO sightings than they do today. It was reported. I did not know that until Dave Marler gave me this article from the St. Louis area about the object. And with regard to my reaction to it, I don't think I was emotionally involved. I was intrigued, as a six-year-old boy might be by something he's seen the first time. I am impressed to this day with how suddenly it accelerated from almost a dead stop to streaking across the sky. And I remember, as it moved in front of us, going away from us, was my impression. It went behind the screen of the theater, and it was following sort of an undulating path in the night sky, and it was just gone. The interesting thing is that all of the people in the tower, across perhaps a mile across the runway from where we were located, including my father, saw this object with binoculars. And I believe I'm correct in saying they saw it on radar as well. So it was a what we call a visual radar sighting, something that was seen by eye and by radar, and was seen by literally certainly hundreds of people, and maybe tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands across the St. Louis area.
That's interesting. Well, let's get into some of the other sightings that you would say were the most important in your years with the UFO Center. What would some of those sightings be? Could you relate them to us?
Yeah, there are two that come to mind immediately, although what I should have done in preparation for this program is send you a list of about 45 or 50 of the most, in my opinion, the most interesting and or dramatic and or well-documented cases I've handled in the last 11 years. The first sighting that comes to mind, of course, is the Phoenix Lights sighting, or actually event, I would call it, of March 13, 1997. It was a dramatic night. In fact, I'll never forget it. It's one of those nights where I just start the tape recorder running as the phone calls flood into the center here in Seattle, and I just record everything without turning the recorder off. It was one of those nights. But I believe it is the case, indisputably the case, that at least tens of thousands and perhaps hundreds of thousands of citizens of Phoenix and surrounding towns in Arizona, as well as up in Nevada, the event started in Nevada, according to our data, were witness to the multiple objects that went over Arizona that night. It was truly dramatic. The size of the objects was noteworthy. The fact that they clearly were intercepted by U.S. Air Force jet fighters. Luke Air Force Base was closed down. The objects, interestingly, passed through the airspace of major airports without transponders and without radio communication, which is a violation of the Federal Aviation Regulations down here in the States, and I presume it's the same in Canada. So that was, without a doubt, the most dramatic UFO-related event that I believe I've ever heard of, the possible exception being the events at Roswell in July of 1947, of course. The second case that comes to mind is from the 5th of January, year 2000, St. Clair County, Illinois, just east of St. Louis, Missouri, on the Mississippi River. The huge, huge triangle that loitered over western Illinois and was seen by the officers of about 8 police departments, some of whom were actually pursuing it at 80 miles an hour in their cruisers. And the object was first seen going south or southwest, and then it reversed its course and disappeared to the north. That was a dramatic one. Then we have the case of the elk that was lifted out of a forest, out of the forest down here near Mount St. Helens. That was on the 25th of February, 1999. 14 witnesses to that. They saw an elk that apparently was killed by a UFO and lifted up out of the forest, and the object flew off with the elk. Dramatic case. And one case I would cite, too, I guess a little-known case, although it's posted to our website, was the very, very peculiar and tragic death of a man in Northumberland County, Pennsylvania, on the 5th of August, actually the 4th of August, we believe, 2002. And it is reported, unfortunately, by an anonymous source, that the man, or a man, was seen being beamed up in a shaft of light, beamed up into a disc-shaped object. This man disappeared, and when his remains were finally found 40 hours later, he was so badly mutilated that not even his son could identify the remains of his own father. That is a very dramatic case. Unfortunately, it was not well investigated after the fact, but there are countless other sightings, and what I've cited is just a handful of the 32,000 cases we have posted to our website.
Well, from many of the reports that I've heard, I have not really heard of any UFO abductee being, you know, seriously harmed. This is the first case I've heard of. Do you think this is a very common occurrence?
No, it's not common as far as we know. There's, of course, the Villaboas case back in 1957. There's also the case, the Cash Landrum case, December 29th, 1980, when three people were extremely badly burned and injured by a UFO down in Texas. There's also the case of the disappearance of Frederick Valentich in early October of 1978. And I believe there are other cases. There was also a case of a Frenchman. There's a case in Falcon Lake, Canada, back in 1967, of a man very badly burned when he allegedly approached a disc that was sitting on the ground there. So they are rare, but these cases are sufficiently well documented, in my opinion, to cause us to back away from the UFO phenomenon and ask ourselves whether, in fact, we might be dealing with a threat or a risk to human beings, to all living forms, and to our planet. That is what is the greatest concern to me. And if you would permit me to add just a short codicil to that statement, in my opinion, the question surrounding the UFO phenomenon that alarms me or concerns me to the greatest degree, and it has to do with the fact that our governments are not apprising us or the citizens of this phenomenon, is whether our governments, the people who call themselves the leaders of our government, might in some way be related to this phenomenon or being influenced by it in some manner, whether they know it or not, directly or indirectly. That is the issue that concerns me the greatest, because the UFO phenomenon, from my vantage point, is real. It's just unambiguous. And yet our governments, certainly the U.S. government, which is the only one I can talk about with any authority, is, I guess I can use the term, lying to the American people. And that concerns me even more than the presence of UFOs on our planet, I find.
Well, some people have speculated that maybe as far back as the 50s that the U.S. has back-engineered anti-gravitic craft and the like, perhaps from the remains of the Roswell crash or even crashes before that in Germany, and that some of this might be, this damaged people might be unintentional damage either by extraterrestrials or Earth-based UFO back-engineered craft from, you know, the effects of radiation or the like.
It's possible, but I seriously doubt it. Good heavens, back in the 50s, we were still flying the F-86 fighter. That was the most advanced fighter. And the likelihood that our scientists were able to mimic or re-engineer or duplicate the technology that apparently allows aliens to come to our planet from distant points of the galaxy is just about zero in my estimation. I know people are talking about anti-gravity and anti-gravitics, and they conjecture about what must be taking place, but I'm the type of person who requires evidence or preferably proof. And I notice that many of those people who talk about it don't offer any kind of evidence. It is pure conjecture. And it's interesting to conjecture, but it doesn't get us down the road in any real respect. And so we have to be careful about that. With regard to injury of human beings, I think it's indisputable now that these craft, some of them, and some of the creatures who presumably power or direct these craft, have caused injury to human beings. And then there's the issue of the mutilation of animals, not only domesticated animals, but wild animals. And, of course, I have to include wild animals because of that case back that I alluded to already in February of 99 when the elk was lifted out of the forest. We found what we think was that elk, deader than a doornail, just about 2 miles north of where this incident occurred. And of course, there have now been about 40,000 documented cases of animal mutilations of farm animals in the United States. What the true dimension of the phenomenon may be, we have no idea at this stage. But it is cause for alarm, and it should cause us to be very cautious with regard to the UFO phenomenon.
Well, there's no doubt that there's been some strange things happening out there. But I think when it comes down to the mutilation of animals, Earth-based Homo sapiens are perhaps the most guilty of that. We're doing it on a regular basis in research laboratories around the world. There are literally millions, hundreds of millions perhaps, of animals killed throughout, you know, the years. So
we eat them.
Not to mention the domesticated animals that are killed on a regular basis for in many instances in inhumane ways for food consumption.
Yep, that's true. We do that, but that's a far cry from the apparent alien relationship to the animal mutilation phenomenon. Animals found with organs missing and incisions that not even the most highly trained surgeon could make. And these are these incisions, of course, are made out in the wilds where no equipment for all intents and purposes is available for it. So I think we have to be very cautious about the UFO phenomenon and recognize that we may live in a universe or a galaxy where competition is the rule more than the exception. And we have to be very careful, I think, about this UFO phenomenon, because there could be some risk involved.
In any of your reports, have you found that there have been friendly or beneficial relations with extraterrestrials? Or you've been focusing on one, you know, the relations that apparently have not been so beneficial to the recipients. Are there, on the other hand, beneficial relations with ETs?
I'm not sure I'm able to answer with any authority on that matter. I would say 99 or 99.9% of all of the cases that are reported to us are essentially sightings of objects in the distance, particularly at night, many of them just unidentified lights. Consequently, I don't feel I have a large enough sample of interaction cases, or what some people call abduction cases, to be able to answer the question. But my position is that if we can show that there have been human beings injured by UFOs, and that, from my vantage point, is almost indisputable. Anybody who's read John Schussler's excellent book on the Cash Landrum case can't walk away from that book without some degree of alarm. I take the position, if there's one human being who is injured by these objects, then we have to be very, very cautious, and we have to get to the bottom of it. People often ask me, well, are aliens good or are aliens bad? Or they ask, what do aliens look like anyway? And I try to point out to them that that's like asking, if you go in the forest, what does an animal look like? Well, it can be anywhere from a butterfly to a Bengal tiger. And given the diversity of life forms on our planet, anywhere from retrovirus to blue whales, we have to recognize that the diversity of life in other parts of the galaxy could be even greater than the diversity of life on our planet. Therefore, I feel we should be prepared for meeting with any kind of creature. And indeed, there's been a broad array of different types of creatures who have been reported by human beings who allegedly have been witness to them. So I think we have to be a little bit cautious on this point.
I've heard it said that there are perhaps many dozens of civilizations that exist in outer space that some people have knowledge of. And one could speculate that there may be some rogue civilizations out there that might be more dangerous than other civilizations. But as Stephen Greer has once put it, if the extraterrestrials wanted to do us any harm, they could have cleaned our clock long ago. They have the advanced technology, perhaps, to enable them to just destroy Earth at a moment's notice.
Well, that's true. And I think they have the technology that would allow them to do it.
And one could also say that the Phoenix Lights sightings, I mean, if those craft had wanted to do damage to the people of Phoenix, they could have easily done so too, but they didn't.
Well,
and in many instances, these craft have been spotted around, for instance, installations like, the intercontinental ballistic missile silos, and they have shown great interest in the fact that we are using atomic weapons to harm each other, and they have interfered in various ways that show that they think that we're endangering ourselves by using these types of weapons. And so from this vantage point, I gather, I infer that these extraterrestrials are perhaps interested in our well-being.
Well, that's possible, but there have been a lot of aircraft that either have disappeared or been shot down. We just got a very interesting report of an incident in the Midwest in which a Phantom, an F-4, McDonnell Douglas F-4 Phantom, was seen to disappear on radar. There's also the celebrated case that's been very well documented by a Canadian researcher of the Kinross event, Kinross Air Force Base. An aircraft was apparently seen to merge with a disc on radar, or an unidentified target, I should say. I don't have any reason to believe that these UFOs are innocuous or don't pose some degree of threat, certainly in the case of some of them. I think we have to be ultra cautious. And with regard to the ICBMs that were incapacitated, it's important to bear in mind that allegedly the nuclear warhead on one of them was melted down. That's a rather dangerous situation. And whether that was an innocuous act or whether it was a careless act on the part of the UFO that allegedly did it, I would have to know more information before I could resolve that. But again, I'm the type who advocates erring on the side of caution.
Okay, well, I thank you very much for appearing today, Peter Davenport. It's been interesting having you on.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. Very nice to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
Thank you.
All right. Bye.
This is Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM, www.cooperadio.org. And we are now 1.5 hours into a 2.5 hour special, no holds barred, on the subject of life in the universe, and does intelligent life exist beyond the geostationary orbit? Are we going to move beyond our 20th century paradigm into a 21st century worldview that perhaps we live in a populated universe, and that Earth, as Professor Leo Sprinkle suggested, based on replicable scientific evidence, may be an entry-level planet, kind of the newest kid on the block, and that we are living in a privileged generation, kind of present at the beginning. But all of this wouldn't be happening without you. And you are our most valuable resource. You are our members. You and we are members. All of us here at the microphone are volunteers. Don is a volunteer. Ron Barber, our operator, is a volunteer. Myself. And we're also all Co-op Radio members, because this is a true cooperative, a listener-sponsored radio station. This is the 30th anniversary of Vancouver Co-op Radio, and it's very fitting that we celebrate it with, among many other programs, a special program on life in the universe. So we're going to ask you now to pick up your telephones, that verbal instrument. Radio is a verbal instrument as well. And call into our special Co-op Radio membership central, where Nina Westaway and Via Bernhausen are waiting. You can call very simply 604-684-8494. That's 604-684-8494, and renew your membership. Well, we're going to go now to our next guest, to a very unusual and to a breakthrough technology. Dr. Courtney Brown is with us today. Dr. Brown is a professor at Emory University and founded the Farsight Institute in 1995. He has written 5 books, two of which are on the subject of remote viewing, which some of you may know about, and this may be a first introduction to this area on behalf of others. He is the innovator of a further development in the science of remote viewing called scientific remote viewing. This will be a sort of a pushing of the envelope, or an entering into a new world view of how we can use the scientific method through remote viewing to explore possible life in the universe. And Dr. Brown is the author of 2 books, Applying Remote Viewing to Investigating the Subject of Extraterrestrial Life, Cosmic Voyage, A Scientific Discovery of Extraterrestrials Visiting Earth, and Cosmic Explorers, Scientific Remote Viewing, Extraterrestrials, and a Message for Mankind. Dr. Brown, who has a forthcoming book on remote viewing, joins us today from Atlanta, Georgia, and I'm privileged to welcome him onto our program. Courtney?
Hi. I'm very pleased to meet you, to speak with you, Alfred.
Great. You know, I must admit that I went through a paradigm shift myself when I took your two books did a self-imposed retreat out on our Salt Spring Island here last summer. And I wondered if you could just walk our listeners through, who may be familiar with but may not be familiar with, exactly what scientific remote viewing is.
Sure. Well, let me explain that the field of remote viewing is new, and it's normal for people not to know anything about it or much about it. And the beginning of the new field of remote viewing really started in the 1970s and 1980s, when the U.S. government invested a considerable amount of money in, through mostly the Central Intelligence Agency, or really the Defense Intelligence Agency, to explore the use of remote viewing as a espionage gathering technique. It's a mental process. Some people would like to call it a psychic process, but people really that know anything about remote viewing don't like to use it, just call it a psychic process, because it's a much more involved thing than what you get with natural psychics who read palms and things like that. Remote viewing is a mental technique, and it's a form of non-physical perception where someone would go into a room that would, in ideal circumstances, be perfectly designed for a remote viewing experience. That would mean there would be very few no bright colors in the room, nothing hanging on the wall, bland colors on the carpet, and nothing visible other than the table and a stack of paper and a pen. And they would begin to describe a target. They would not be told anything about the nature of the target, other than the fact that there is a target. And a target is something, some place, location, event, person, whatever in the past, present, or future that there is a need to know information about that. So some person in some agency or whatever would say, we need to know some information about XYZ, assign a remote viewer to do it. The remote viewer would not be told anything at all other than, go do it. They would not be told anything about what the target is, whether it was a place or an event or whatever. And let's say the target actually turned out to be the Eiffel Tower, but you know, the remote viewer would not know that. They'd go into this room, and using a stack of paper over a period of about an hour, would come out with about 20 pages of written information plus carefully drawn sketches describing that location, and a good remote viewing session would have very good sketches of the Eiffel Tower with the surrounding Paris environment and so on, people at the time and the people that would be there at the time and location, so on. So then after the session is completely finished, the remote viewer would then be told what the target actually was, that it was in fact the Eiffel Tower, and the remote viewer and others would be able to compare the data, which are recorded on a piece of paper, with the actual target of the Eiffel Tower. And the target may be represented by a picture or a video or a film of the Eiffel Tower at some place, at some location, at some point in time. So that's the basic idea of that, the ability to perceive something mentally without being told what it is. Remote viewing does not work if you're told what it is. So it's not like if you became really good, you could be told, remote view this, and you could remote view it. It doesn't work that way. The conscious mind literally has to be ignorant of whatever you're trying to find out in order for the process to work very well. So people train for a long time, both in the government and outside, and there are now a whole bunch of former military remote viewers who are in the private sector and teaching remote viewing and writing books about remote viewing and so on like that. They do not really involve myself. I'm a civilian. I've never been in the military. And we have taken the one version of the original military procedure called controlled remote viewing and modified them very significantly to suit our own needs. There was nothing wrong with controlled remote viewing, which is the original military version, one of the versions that was used. It's a very solid procedure, but we wanted to change things for our own purposes, and we adapted the procedures to fit our own use of our own definition of the scientific method, where things could be controlled in our laboratories a little better, the way we liked it to be controlled. And so we renamed it scientific remote viewing. I should also add that the procedures themselves are of great variety. There's a number of different procedures. Some are called, as I said, a controlled remote viewing. Others are called the Hawaiian Remote Viewing Guild. That's done by a nonprofit organization in Hawaii led by a former military remote viewer called Glenn Wheaton. And he was in Special Forces. He was not in the DIA. And that's a very, very, very interesting group, and Glenn is a very talented remote viewer. And then, of course, there's scientific remote viewing, which is what we do here at the Farsight Institute. Farsight, that's F-A-R-S-I-G-H-T. And just like the Hawaiian Remote Viewing Guild, the Farsight Institute is a nonprofit. And then there are other people who do controlled remote viewing. Lynn Buchanan is a very prominent remote viewing instructor. Lynn Buchanan is a former military remote viewer who worked with the defense in the DIA and in the intelligence gathering wing of the Army. And there are others, many that are, you know, some of them are quite famous and using various different methodologies. Skip Atwater at the Monroe Institute uses audio mechanisms in Faber, Virginia, for remote viewing. Joe McMonagle, also living on the East Coast in the United States, a former military remote viewer, has his own very successful methods for remote viewing. So there are different styles. What really is the focus of the Farsight Institute and my own work in remote viewing is not so much the particular style of remote viewing, but the use of remote viewing to explore issues relating to consciousness, the science of consciousness, most particularly the areas of physics. We're using remote viewing to ask some really fundamental questions regarding cosmology, time, physics, quantum mechanics in particular. Now, you mentioned a couple of my books dealing with extraterrestrial life. You must understand that those books were applications of remote viewing. Those are not basic science books. They're not science books in themselves. They're applications, and they reflect my own personal hobby or my own personal interest in using remote viewing to speculatively explore the idea of extraterrestrial life, because all remote viewing data are speculative. You can never say that something exists because you remote viewed it. Anything that is remote viewed is just perceptions, and those perceptions have to be corroborated by the normal physical means of corroborating data. So if you remote view something with regard to extraterrestrial life, no matter how clear your perceptions are, those perceptions are speculative. And until we actually get physical verification of those data, they have to remain speculative. That does not mean that a remote viewer who has a solid track record for successfully remote viewing verified targets could not produce data that you'd really want to spend a lot of money and exert a lot of effort to obtain that corroboration, because that's exactly what you use remote viewing for. If you have a very competent remote viewer or group of remote viewers obtaining information about extraterrestrial activity, then in fact, even though the remote viewing data themselves are speculative, you then have a lot of information that you need to corroborate, and you need to, you really want to spend the resources, both financial and with personnel, to get that verification, because remote viewing really helps you target, focus in on what you need to get verified. And in fact, you can have remote viewing data that are 100% perfectly accurate, but you'll never know that until the data are corroborated. Once the data are corroborated, then you can know how much is accurate and how much is not accurate. But in general, with good remote viewers who are well practiced and who follow a standardized remote viewing style or data collection set of methodologies, then you can have very high accuracy rates and very solid track records, and you really do want to follow up some of those speculative batches of data that suggest that, in fact, there may indeed be good, solid leads on extraterrestrial life, UFOs, things like that.
Right. Now, since the focus of our program is on life in the universe, I was wondering if you could share with our listeners, some of whom are somewhat familiar or very familiar with this subject matter, some of whom may be not that familiar with it and not familiar with remote viewing at all, but perhaps some of the replicable, you know, some of the replicable discoveries or speculative scenarios that were replicated, which is the basis of the scientific method.
Sure.
in your remote viewing relating to extraterrestrials visiting Earth or content of an extraterrestrial civilization's messages.
Sure. Well, let me say there's two parts to your question. And the first part is the replicable component, which is the methodology component. And so that we can focus more on the content of the topic of the show, let me just state that the method is of remote viewing that your viewers, your listeners can go to our website, which is that we are a non-profit educational research organization. And for any of you who are listening out there who are skeptical and thinking that the only reason anyone would do any research on psychic or psi phenomena is to scam people and make money, let's put that to rest. I have never taken any compensation any financial compensation at all for my work as director of the non-profit, the Farsight Institute. And that's the same as Glenn Wheaton out in the Hawaiian Remote Viewing Guild, for example. Anyway, our website is www.farsight, that's F-A-R-S-I-G-H-T, like seeing far, farsight.org, which is O-R-G, because we're a non-profit organization, farsight.org. And on that website, we have huge amounts of educational information, complete descriptions of all the procedures for free, plus we have results of a six-month public demonstration of remote viewing that was done with exacting scientific controls, and all types of verifiable targets can be or verifiable remote viewing demonstrations can be examined there. With that said, I can say that with my two books that have been published in the previously, and again I have a new book, but that's on the scientific method, on the science of remote viewing, that's coming out next month. But my previous books, which were applications of remote viewing focusing on the extraterrestrial phenomenon or the extraterrestrial question, suggest, and again these are speculative until these data are eventually corroborated, I suspect they probably are correct, but I just, like everyone else, has to wait and find out. But the data have been obtained by so many remote viewers under so many different conditions. At this point, I'm not a betting man. I don't believe in gambling. But if I was, I'd bet everything on the fact that most of the data are probably correct. Is that there indeed was not only life on Mars long ago, but highly evolved life on Mars, humanoid life on Mars, and that there was, in fact, a civilization that probably was comparable to the ancient Egyptian civilization of 3,000 years ago on Earth, and that they were wiped out by a planetary cataclysm not of their own making, meaning it wasn't an ecological destruction like the type that we're doing on our planet, but something different, something like an asteroid or a comet impacting or brushing very close to the planet that disrupted the atmosphere and disrupted planetary life, and they had to those that could evacuate were apparently evacuated by yet another extraterrestrial group, which I call the Greys, which is an unfortunate name. I don't like calling people by a color, but that's what they're popularly known as, these short little guys with wraparound eyes. And they were a very advanced extraterrestrial species that apparently is able to traverse not only space, large distances, but also time with technology. Now, for those of you who say that's impossible, you can't do that, you have to understand that remote viewing under verifiable conditions, using verifiable targets with exacting scientific controls, clearly penetrates any time barriers that can be imagined to exist. Meaning you can remote view into the past, you can remote view the present, or you can remote view the future with some caveats with regard to some types of targets. For example, numerical targets are very difficult, but descriptive targets of geographical locations, places, events, people are routinely done. And so it is without question a capability to be able to transfer information across time. And if we can do that using the physical machinery of a human body, then it's certainly reasonable to think that some species, intelligent species that's been intelligent and evolving for a million years longer than we have, could have developed technological capabilities of moving in time. Meaning, our understanding of physics with regard to quantum mechanics and relativity is incomplete. Not wrong, but incomplete. And that what remote viewing is showing us, more than anything else, is that we are in for a sea change in our understanding of physical reality. Now, there's been a long dispute among the relativists, the physicists who focus on relativity theory, in their understanding of the universe, and those physicists who deal with quantum mechanics, who look at quantum events, because the quantum world doesn't correspond with the macro world. The things that happen on the macro level seem to obey laws of relativity, and you can't go faster than the speed of light, and there's all types of things like that. On the quantum level, everything is the opposite. You can have instantaneous information transfer across any distance at all, galactic distance, using processes known as entanglement. And there are other things that are involved in the quantum world that simply don't make sense. So the understanding of physics is a hugely interesting and greatly challenging science for us right now. It's a shame, actually, that the U.S. government is retreating so heavily at the current time in expending money on research and development, especially in areas of physics, cosmology, and all basic sciences in general. We're becoming a broke country, I'm sorry to say, but we're bankrupting ourselves faster than a third world nation. But that's a political story to be told, not a scientific story. But hopefully, as the years go on, other people will find in their own national resources to keep on exploring with regard to physics and cosmology and quantum mechanics, and those people who are able to continue those explorations here in the United States will also do that. But the reality is we're in for a huge sea change with regard to our understanding of reality. And of course we can assume that any advanced extraterrestrial civilization would have known that long ago. And so we can assume that they would have the same capabilities that we are just beginning to understand are possible.
This is extraordinary. Our time is just flying by so quickly, Courtney, and
right.
we have just a couple of minutes left in your segment, and we hope that sometime in the future you'll be able to come back and we can go into all of these very interesting ramifications in more depth.
Well, Albert, what you should think about, since time is always short, is that a radio interview like this is most pregnant because is most valuable not so much because of the information that's transferred during the moment, because it's always short, but because of its pregnancy effect, meaning it gives birth to a period of exploration. So the listeners have the ability to spend some time now going onto the web, to our website as a starter, and in the month of May, we will have a new book out which will deal with these subjects. The new book is called Remote Viewing, The Science and Theory of Non-Physical Perception, and it will be coming out in May. And it goes into these subjects in great depth. And so it's not so much that you can cover the universe in 1.5 hour, but in 1.5 hour you can open the eyes and alert people to where they can get more information, and they can spend a lifetime exploring literally these mysteries that keep you on the edge of the seat every day.
Well, let me just in the remaining minute or so that we have here, in terms of a possible society or organized society out there of civilizations, some of your replicable scenarios relate to possible universe governance structures, and I wondered if you could just say a few words about this.
Well, we know from our own planets, our own species existence on this planet, is that wherever there is intelligent life organizes itself. There's, even in the worst of situations, where anarchy has evolved in this planet, only a matter of years goes by before people start to try to organize some form of governance, some type of organization. Well, clearly, if there is extraterrestrial life, and if they have overcome the hurdles of transportation, then the very next thing is a political question. It's not a technological question. And this goes to your expertise, Alfred, which is as a lawyer interested in large-scale governance, which is what would they do? How would they organize themselves? So when New Age communities talk about the idea of a galactic federation, well, in one sense, it's sort of just a fluffy New Age term with no proof that such a thing ever exists. But in reality, it's the most logical thing. If there is extraterrestrial life, and if the technological hurdles have been overcome for transportation, which I'm, in my mind, seems almost inevitable that that would happen, since the remote viewing data themselves suggest that information transfer minimally can be gotten instantaneously over any length of distance. So my thought is that there must be some form of galactic council, galactic federation, galactic organization, sort of like a United Nations. I also suspect strongly that there are limits to how many societies would belong to such an organization before it became too unwieldy to be effective. So there's probably many such organizations. What is the optimal number of participants in any particular organization within any one galaxy? I don't know. Maybe 100, 60, 150, maybe 200, maybe 1,000, I don't know. But if it gets too big, it will become unwieldy. So I suspect there are groups of galactic organizations, and that they satisfy their members' needs. Some of their members' needs may be defense-oriented. Some of them may be technological exchange. Some of them may be evolution-oriented, biological evolution-oriented. They may want to enhance their physical experience in this physical realm. I don't really know, but it seems an obvious next choice. Once the technology has been overcome, the very next question is a political one, which is how do you organize groups that bump into each other out there? And so the remote viewing data does suggest that, in fact, there are such groups. And some remote viewers, including myself, have attempted to remote view one such group that we call the Galactic Federation on a number of instances. And that's the interesting news. The bad news is we don't have physical verification of that group. The good news is that they seem to be friendly. So you can look
well,
at it
well, that's good.
Whatever way you want.
You know, Courtney, we've come to the end of this very, very dynamic chat with you. We're really looking forward, all of us, to the publication of your new book, and hope that in the future perhaps you can come on again and we can talk about your book.
Well, God bless you, and I want to thank you for inviting me. I also should mention I'll be up in Canada pretty soon.
Oh, good. Where?
I'll be at the in Montreal at the International, the IIIHS, which is the international conference that's held up in Montreal, run by John and Marilyn Rosner. I'll be there. It goes over a few weeks, but I'll be there on Friday, the May 27th, and Saturday, May 28th, giving a talk in Montreal. And they, of course, have their own website. I think it's IIIHS.org, if I'm... Yeah, that's what it is, IIIHS.org. And they have many, many speakers, but I enjoy going to Canada whenever I can, and I'm glad to be able to come up north with you guys.
Excellent. Okay, then. Well, thank you very much.
God bless you, and have a good day, and thank you for inviting me.
Courtney, thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Well, this is the last segment coming up in our program, and we do urge you, there have been a number of calls come in, but we do need much more support. I'm just reading from a printing here from our program coordinator, I believe, and it says... Our membership development goal set by MLC, Membership and Outreach Committee, is based on a 5-year membership plan to create a sustainable annual budget for the station of $250,000. In order to achieve this, we need to aim for an overall target of 5,000 paid members at the average $50 membership level. Currently, we have 1,700 members. To reach our goal, we will need to add 660 new members each year for the next 5 years. This works out to 5 new members per hour of programming. So, in other words, we, being an hourly program, we need to get 5 new members this program. And we also have to keep our former members, too. So if you are, if you did become a member last year and your membership is about to lapse, we would urge you to phone up and renew your membership and keep Co-op Radio going, because we are the only radio station in Vancouver that is, I believe, that is listener sponsored and that is able to bring you programming such as this, or maybe I should rephrase that, that has had the gall to bring you radio programming such as this, or the courage. Anyway, we're breaking new ground here, and we're going to find out why this new ground is so important to us on the planet Earth at this time. And our next guest is my co-programmer, Alfred Lambermont Weber, JD, MED. And I suppose a lot of you didn't realize that one of the co-programmers of the Monday Brown Bagger is sort of also wearing a lot of other hats, and sort of a superstar in a way of this field. He's called the... I'll just read you his blurb here. Not all of it. Alfred is an author, futurist, lawyer, member of the District of Columbia Bar, peace advocate, environmental activist, space activist, and is known as the founding father of exopolitics. Alfred Weber was director of a proposed 1977 Carter White House off-planet culture communication project as futurist at Stanford Research Institute. President Jimmy Carter reported his own 1969 UFO encounter and made a 1976 election campaign promise to create more transparency with the UFO issue. This initiative was ended in the fall of 1977 because of the political climate at the time. Today, Alfred Weber is the international director of the Institute for Cooperation in Space, in other words, also called ISIS, promoting the vision of banning space weapons and transforming the permanent war economy into a peaceful and cooperative space exploration society focused on studying life in the universe. So, welcome as a guest on the Brown Bagger, Alfred.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Don.
Could we start off with you sort of explaining and just, you know, break in with this issue anytime if you want to make a preamble, but explaining the meaning of exopolitics.
Sure. You know, and I'd sort of like to explain it by way of historical example and kind of bringing it back home, because it turns out that Canada, our Canada, is probably one of the leading, quote, exopolitical nations on the planet. And if you want to know what exopolitics is, think of exobiology being the study of biological life forms in the universe. Well, exopolitics is the study of, or a process by which, a universe probably filled with intelligent civilizations, how they operate under the universal law, under possible universe governance mechanisms that we're beginning to know about or access preliminarily, and mediated through a process of universe politics. One of the great books by Bernard Crick, an Oxford University professor, was In Defense of Politics. So there's a very positive side to politics, and that is how intelligent beings can kind of mediate amongst each other in terms of interests and interests of groups. And so I'd like to bring it all back home with a very poignant example. And this was back during the cabinet of Lester Pearson in 1963. Paul Hellyer became the Minister of National Defense of Canada. He was quite a remarkable Minister of Defense. He oversaw the controversial integration and unification of the Canadian Army, the Royal Canadian Navy, and the Royal Canadian Air Force, and also implemented the Blue Beret, that is, brought Canada's military into kind of its peacekeeping function. Now, that, you know, there's a lot of pressures on that. But the way that this becomes exopolitically significant, that is, how Canada structurally and officially made space for a universe society or some representatives of off-planet cultures to show up, was that on June 3rd, and this is a matter of historical record that is little known, 1967, while Minister of Defense of Canada, Paul Hellyer, flew in by helicopter to officially inaugurate an off-planet cultures landing pad in St. Paul, Alberta. St. Paul had built this landing pad officially as part of its Canadian Centennial Celebration Project and as a symbol of keeping space free from human warfare. And this relates to a lot of the space preservation resolutions that our Vancouver City Council and all the city councils here in British Columbia have been passing over the last several years. Mm-hmm. Now, the sign that Minister of Defense Paul Hellyer inaugurated in 1967, the sign on the pad reads, "The area under the world's first UFO landing pad was designated international by the town of St. Paul as a symbol of our faith that mankind will maintain the outer universe free from national wars and strife, that future travel in space will be safe for all intergalactic beings. All visitors from Earth or otherwise are welcome to this territory and to the town of St. Paul." And that was the government of Lester B. Pearson through the instrumentality of his Minister of Defense, Paul Hellyer, and that was in 1967. So I think that certain elements within Canadian society have always seen the issue of governmental relations and personal freedoms as a continuum. A continuum which does not stop arbitrarily at the geostationary orbit. The geostationary orbit is 22,242 miles up, and that's the point at which a satellite appears to be stationary. So you can put mm-hmm. a satellite in that orbit, and it will always be over Vancouver, Canada. Yeah. And for those who don't know it. So what we have been able to do is to build on this legacy in Canada, and it was not only in Canada, incidentally, it's also in the world. In the same way that we've had in a purely terrestrial context, say, if you take the war in Iraq, you know, well, there were weapons of mass destruction. You know, this is sort of the disinformational basis of that war. It's language that our listeners would understand very well. There's also a disinformational basis to maintaining what we can call the fossil fuel nuclear civilization here on Earth, which is controlled by a very narrow plutocratic elite. And the significance of our joining universe society, that is a society of advanced civilizations, is that we would have to transform our permanent war economy into more of a cooperative, sustainable economy built on sustainable energy sources without war as a conflict resolution mechanism, and, you know, kind of grow up.
Yeah.
Well, if you look at the United Nations General Assembly going back as far as 1978, this is United Nations General Assembly Decision 33-426, adopted on December 18th, 1978, and this was at the time that we were carrying out on behalf of the Jimmy Carter White House, who himself had a close UFO encounter uh-huh. in 1969 while he was running for governor of Georgia. What the United Nations General Assembly said is, quote, "The General Assembly invites interested member states to take appropriate steps to coordinate on a national level scientific research and investigation into extraterrestrial life, including unidentified flying objects, and to inform the Secretary General of the observations, research, and evaluation." And the General Assembly recommended establishing a UN secretariat or department to deal with the question of extraterrestrial life. So we'd have kind of a planet, you know, take me to your leader. Yeah. We would have sort of a point of contact from a structural, legal, sort of treaty point of view to begin to join up the worlds. Now, it's very instructive to note that this General Assembly decision, which was sponsored by the Republic of Grenada in 1978, well, 4 years later under President Reagan, I think Grenada was invaded, wasn't it? What we have done is to build on, to really build on a solid foundation, and what we call an extraterrestrial platform or an extraterrestrial initiative. And I know there are only 10 minutes left in this segment, but Don, I really want to keep it home and keep it kind of grounded. So what we've been able to do, and by we I mean the Institute for Cooperation in Space, which is a nonprofit that I represent, that has been very active in the fight against ballistic missile defense and the weaponization of space. You can imagine that the kind of the empty chair at the table of any space treaty at this point would be the representatives of the universe society. They don't want a warlike species out there. So bottom line is that we have taken a page from the Honorable Paul Hellyer. And on March 10th, 2005, in Winnipeg, before the Senate of Canada Standing Committee on National Security and Defense, represented by there were three senators there: Senator Norman Atkins, Senator Michael Mann, and Senator Jim Munson, who used to be Jean Chrétien's press secretary. We presented a statement and proposal for a Canadian exopolitics initiative. And you might ask, well, what's an exopolitics initiative? That's sort of taking this whole subject matter out of the military defense agencies, where it's been out of CSIS, out of CIA, out of DIA, out of Star Wars, and putting it where it should be, in the Ministry of Education. Mm-hmm. So that our school curricula can be turned around and be accurate, so that kids in kindergarten come up and learn about a populated universe and kind of open education, government-funded scientific research.
Instead of looking at the issue as a trivialized issue, you know, and one that a lot of fun and spoofing is being made of.
Exactly. And what came up on the recent Chum television special, a 2.5-hour special, is very controversial, but they made some good points. One point is that in the 1950s, the U.S. government put this whole issue into what they called Operation Blue Book, and the documents have come out that Operation Blue Book was a CIA disinformation operation, and the documents say that the entire weight of the U.S. military intelligence apparatus has been to stigmatize, to stereotype, and to use the ridicule factor to separate any contact and to not permit our rightful contact with our brothers and sisters from other populated worlds.
Yeah.
And so it's a human rights issue. Mm-hmm. And I find it very instructive that Canada has consistently taken the high road regarding to space. Canada first introduced 20 years ago a treaty at the UN to ban all weapons and warfare in space. Here we have in 1967 the Minister of Defense of Canada inaugurating an intergalactic landing pad. I mean, how much more can you have? Mm-hmm. And so in that line, what we've done is to formally file on March 10th before the Standing Committee on National Security and Defense this statement and proposal for a Canadian exopolitics initiative, which would do two things, actually three things. Number one, it would be under the aegis of the United Nations resolution of the General Assembly of 1978. In other words, this is what the world wants. It wants open relations with extraterrestrial civilizations. And at the initial hearings, Senator Michael Mann, who's a very progressive fellow, member of the Progressive Conservatives. I guess the progressive wing of the Progressive Conservatives, said, yes, the United Nations kind of, you know, this platform, the fact that for 30 years now almost we've had this on the record is very important. The second two factors is that we can, I mean, the Canadian Senate has taken the forefront in the legalization of marijuana. Mm-hmm. It's taken the forefront on same-sex marriage. This is a body which can sit back over time. It's not subject to the same kind of daily political warfare and, you know, I'm right and you're wrong. This is a zero-sum game. It's not win-win. It's win-lose 24/7, as we're witnessing now. They can take a longer range point of view, and you know, so what we've tabled is a proposal for an exopolitical initiative which has two components. The first component actually goes without saying, and that is an acknowledgement that we live, there's good evidence or suggestive evidence that we live in a populated universe.
There's a lot of evidence.
Yeah, and that advanced, spiritually advanced off-planet cultures are now visiting Earth, and they have been authorized.
You just have to look at all the testimonials in Project Disclosure.
Exactly.
Over 100. Just that alone, with any rational thinking person would show that there is no doubt that extraterrestrial civilizations exist and are in contact of some kind with Earth.
Exactly. And now, so that the second component of our initiative is that the Canadian government would undertake an open, what we call a decade of contact, and kind of take the lead worldwide here as we have in so many issues. Open a decade, a 10-year period of open, funded public education, scientific research, community outreach, kind of making it safe and okay to explore this. You know, we don't have the Galileo syndrome, which is burn him at the stake or burn her at the stake.
Yeah.
You know, and cut off all funding and the free flow of the ridicule factor, which is nothing but a CIA disinformation artifact,
yeah,
in a policy decision made by military intelligence agencies now acknowledged back in the 1950s. Why mm-hmm. should we have our mind space and our science subject to that kind of totalitarian rule?
Yeah, it's the military fear factor.
Exactly. The third element is the beginnings of public interest diplomacy with spiritually advanced off-planet cultures. And here, you know, we were part of, during the Glasnost period, you may recall in the 1980s and the 1990s, when Gorbachev first came in, we had Perestroika, an attempt. I mean, there's been a lot of water over the dam since then, and it's a very murky situation.
Right.
But many NGOs, ourselves included, took part in an effort to reach out over the Iron Curtain, that is, this kind of artificial separation the permanent warfare economy had set up between two enemies to keep the Cold War going. So it's a similar type of Canada taking a first step in establishing public interest diplomacy with off-planet cultures. Their whole treaty regimes which can be put in place, and some of the initial techniques in the remote viewing area, kind of, you know, there's ways that we can begin to explore this. So as recently as last week, we were, you know, in our hat as an NGO, a non-governmental organization, we were in touch with the offices of the various senators, and we'll be following through on this initiative. In fact, next Monday, April 26, we'll be announcing the Canadian exopolitical initiative at a press conference at probably the premier political venue in the United States, at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., where 3 or 4 years ago on May of 2001, May 9th, the Disclosure Project press conference was held. We're going to be holding a similar press conference next Monday, a week from today, so it's very opportune. And I'm really glad that Co-op Radio is, you know, opening up. We've been at the political forefront, and this is like keeping the home fires burning and just one more step.
Yeah. We have about 3 minutes left. Yeah, it seems to me, and maybe you could comment on this, Peter Davenport painted a rather negative picture of extraterrestrial life forms, in that they are hostile and we should be very wary of them. But it seems to me, it's just a matter of common sense, that if life forms advance technologically, you know, way beyond what we're at now, that they would have tremendous capabilities of, you know, destruction. They would have advanced weaponry and so forth. And if they retained the same sort of mindset that some Earth people have now, among the elites especially, that they indeed would be a danger to each other within you know, a populated galaxy and a populated universe, and that could just not stand. I mean, you would have to have some sort of method of you know, nullifying that aggressive tendency and cooperating with each other. And it seems to me that they must have this. Otherwise, we would be probably toast on the Earth here.
Well, to kind of reframe the issue, Don. This is going to be our guest on Monday, May 2nd, Dr. Paul LaViolette, who has inaugurated the research on the galactic superwave. It appears that our galaxy is highly unstable, maybe like a large volcano, very, very briefly, and that the December 26, 2004 tsunami may in fact have been the result of gamma ray outbursts from a neutron star exploding about 50 million light years ago in the constellation Sagittarius, that accompanies the galactic superwave, which reaches our solar system about every 13,000 or 26,000 years, which conforms to the Mayan calendar. And already, you know, we're having 70-foot waves that knock off ocean liners, and we have the tsunami. I've read Dr. LaViolette's experience. Some chunks, let me just bottom line it here.
Okay.
And the
229. Yeah,
229. The suggestion is that Universe Society started the UFO outreach to kind of warn us in 1947, the galactic superwave is coming. You guys better get it together.
Well, okay, and we'll be talking more about that in future programs, the galactic superwave and other issues related to ETs. Well, okay, that's it for today, I guess, then. If you haven't phoned in to support Co-op Radio, now's your chance. The number is 604-684-8494. That's 604-684-8494. This is Don Norden and Alfred Weber saying goodbye for now. I hope you enjoyed today's special. See you next week.